Picture this. It's a sticky, humid July afternoon. You know, you're sitting in your living room, maybe trying to beat the heat, when the sky just suddenly turns the color of a fresh
Oh
bruise.
yeah, the bottom just drops right out.
Exactly. The wind starts howling, rain is coming down in absolute sheets, and like before you can even grab your phone to check the radar, you hear that massive, sickening crack.
The worst sound.
Right. You look out the window. And a 60-foot oak tree is just down across your street, takes the power lines with it. But here's the crazy part. You walk one block over, and people are sitting on their porches reading
Yeah,
books.
totally untouched.
Right? Like maybe a few leaves blew around, but their neighborhood is perfectly fine. How does a storm single out your street and just leave the next one completely alone?
Well, that extreme localization is, I mean, it's honestly one of the most frustrating phenomena in meteorology.
Yeah.
When you're standing there and your roof just lost its shingles, but your neighbor didn't even lose a lawn chair.
It feels completely random.
Sure does. It feels entirely random.
So today, we're putting on our meteorologist hats for a deep dive into this elusive and honestly pretty terrifying summer threat. We are talking about wet downbursts.
A huge issue this time of year.
Yeah, and our guide for this is a fascinating new study by Andrew Moore from the NOAA Storm Prediction Center. The paper looks at high-resolution simulations of these downbursts, and reading through this research feels like, I don't know, finding the ultimate cheat code to understanding why summer storms act the way they do.
It really is. Moore's work is incredibly important here because it tackles this fundamental blind spot in weather forecasting. I mean, we have all these massive multi-million-dollar tools at our disposal, right?
Right, like satellites and stuff.
Exactly. Satellites in orbit, advanced Doppler radar networks, supercomputers doing trillions of calculations a second. And yet, these localized summer storms still manage to completely blindside us.
Snapping power poles with basically zero warning.
Right. And crushing cars.
Well, I definitely want to get into why our instruments are totally missing these things, but before we do, we kind of need to look at the anatomy of what is actually falling out of the sky here. We're dealing with what meteorologists call weakly forced thunderstorms, or WFTs.
Yeah, you might also hear them called pulse storms or air mass thunderstorms.
Pulse storms, right. And these are the short-lived, poorly organized storms that just kind of bubble up on a hot afternoon, especially in the eastern and southeastern U.S.
And that lack of organization is really the defining feature here. I mean, these aren't your massive rotating supercells sweeping across Tornado Alley, you know, with a highly defined
You're
structure.
right. Totally different beast.
Exactly. A pulse storm is much simpler. It basically goes up as warm air rises, and eventually, well, it has to come down. And the mechanics of that coming down phase are what create the wet downburst.
Okay, so walk me through that.
Sure. So imagine a column of air high up inside this towering storm cloud. As rain begins to fall out of it, two very distinct things happen. First, you have a precipitation drag.
Which is what exactly.
It's literally the physical friction of thousands of gallons of liquid water falling and pulling the surrounding air down with it.
Wow. Okay, so just gravity and friction doing their thing. The rain is literally dragging the sky down.
Precisely. But the second factor is actually much more powerful, and that's evaporative cooling. As that rain falls out of the cloud and through the drier air closer to the ground, some of that water evaporates before it even hits the dirt.
And evaporation absorbs heat, right? Like when you step out of a swimming pool on a breezy day and you suddenly feel freezing cold.
That is a perfect way to visualize it, yeah.
Huh.
The water evaporating off your skin is literally pulling the heat away.
So the same thing is happening in the sky.
Exactly. Inside the storm, that evaporation pulls heat out of the surrounding air, cooling it really rapidly. And because cold air is denser and heavier than warm air, this cooled pocket of air starts to sink.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it becomes this runaway freight train of dense cold air and heavy water just plummeting straight down toward the surface.
Okay, so let's visualize this impact. If a regular rain shower is like pouring water from a pitcher, a downburst is like more like dropping a giant water balloon onto your driveway.
That's a great analogy, actually.
Thanks. So it hits the concrete and splatters violently in every possible direction. And the leading edge of that splatter pushing outward is what meteorologists call the cold pool or the gust front.
Right. But what's really crucial here is what is happening inside that splatter. The outflow doesn't just spread perfectly evenly, you know, like a smooth wave of water.
It's messier than that.
Way messier. Embedded within that broader outward push of wind, you get these tiny chaotic features called mesoscale burst swaths.
Mesoscale, that just means really, really small, right?
Yeah, it has a microscopic spatial footprint, usually on the order of maybe just 100 meters across. These are little ripples of extreme, concentrated, just violently fast winds hiding inside the larger gust front.
Wait, so we aren't just getting hit by a wall of wind, we're getting hit by a wall of wind that has these microscopic buzzsaws of energy hidden inside it.
I like that, microscopic buzzsaws.
Yeah.
Yeah, that transition from vertical falling air to horizontal wind right at the surface, that is where the maximum destruction happens. The air hits the ground, gets forced outward violently, and creates these localized peak velocities that can easily, you know, snap a mature, healthy tree right in half.
Okay, but if these buzzsaws are so incredibly dangerous and they cause, like, millions in property damage every single summer, how can we not see them coming? Like, why can't a forecaster just look at a radar screen and issue a warning for my specific street?
It's a huge frustration for forecasters, believe me. And it really comes down to the physical geometry of our observing networks. So let's look at radar first. The National Network of Doppler Radars is a modern marvel. But the peak horizontal winds in a downburst usually happen very close to the ground, typically between, say, 50 and 200 meters up in the air.
Which doesn't really sound that high.
It isn't. And because the Earth is curved and a radar beam shoots out in a straight line at a slight upward angle, that beam gets higher and higher above the ground the further away it travels.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. So unless the storm happens to be sitting practically right on top of the radar dome, say, within 10 kilometers or so, the radar beam physically overshoots that shallow layer of extreme wind.
Wow, it's just looking right over the top of the actual danger.
Exactly. It completely misses it.
But wait, we don't just rely on radar anymore, right? I mean, I have a weather app on my phone. My neighbor actually has a personal weather station mounted on his fence.
A lot of people do these days.
Yeah, it feels like there is a digital thermometer and a wind gauge in every single town in the country. How does a major tree-snapping wind event completely dodge our entire ground detection grid?
It's an illusion of scale, really. We think we're covered because we can pull up a temperature reading pretty much anywhere. But let's look at the station spacing of professional weather observing networks, what meteorologists call mesonets. The automated stations you see at airports, they're spaced about 44 kilometers apart on average. And even in states that have built dense state-of-the-art networks, like the Oklahoma Mesonet, the stations are still roughly 30 kilometers apart.
Okay, 30 kilometers, that's what, almost 19 miles between each station?
Right. And a 30-kilometer grid is fantastic for tracking broad weather systems, you know, like a massive winter storm or a widespread cold front.
Sure.
But remember the size of a downburst's burst swath. It's maybe a few hundred meters wide.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to detect a 100-meter wind event with weather stations placed 30 kilometers apart is, well, it's like dropping a sewing needle from the ceiling onto a hardwood floor.
And hoping it lands standing up.
Exactly. Hoping it lands perfectly standing up in the tiny crack between the floorboards.
That is wild. It's basically a massive observational blind spot. And this study points out that this blind spot causes a huge problem for weather history, right? Because if a storm hits a town and does real damage, but completely misses the nearest weather station 20 miles away,
it goes into the record books based on the broken trees, not an actual measured wind speed.
Right. So we're just flying blind, recording the aftermath rather than the event itself.
Yeah. And because our physical instruments just can't catch these micro events reliably, Moore's study had to pivot. You can't manage what you can't measure. So the researchers turned to high-resolution supercomputer modeling to figure out what's really happening down at the street level.
The methodology here is so cool. They used something called the Brian Cloud Model, or CM1. And they didn't just run a couple of generic storm models. They ran 97 high-resolution simulations.
That's a lot of computing power.
Yeah, and to get the detail they needed, they built the digital environment for these storms using a 100-meter grid.
Right, and to put that into perspective, global weather forecasting models might look at blocks of the atmosphere that are miles and miles wide. This study shrunk that down to looking at chunks of the atmosphere, basically the length of a football field.
It's an incredibly high-definition look at storm dynamics. But the really rigorous part is how they initialized these models. I mean, they didn't just guess what the atmosphere might look like on a stormy day.
No, they used real-world data.
Right, exactly. They pulled actual thermodynamic environments from a database of over 13,000 real wind damage reports from across the United States. And this is between 2018 and 2021.
Wow.
Yeah. They filtered that massive data set specifically for weekly forced thunderstorm environments days with low wind shear and high moisture. Then they fed those exact atmospheric ingredients into the supercomputer to build these 97 Frankenstein storms.
So they essentially cloned the exact conditions of real days where actual damage was reported.
Yes. But I do want to pause here and look at a limitation the author is very upfront about. These are modeled results, obviously. And to make the math work, they had to assume perfectly flat terrain.
Right. No hills, no valleys.
Exactly. But more importantly, supercomputers really struggle to perfectly simulate how wind scrapes against literal dirt, grass, and buildings, what they call surface friction.
That's always tricky in modeling.
So because of that limitation, the study had to use wind speeds simulated at 50 meters in the air as a proxy for surface gusts down at 10 meters. And I just have to ask, are we, like, cheating a bit here? I mean, can we really use winds 160 feet in the air to guess what's happening to the roof of my house?
You know, it's a completely fair question, and it definitely sounds like a cheat at first glance.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually a really well-documented and accepted practice in both meteorology and wind engineering.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Observational studies using very tall, highly instrumented towers have shown that in thunderstorm outflows, the intense momentum from 50 or 80 meters up absolutely mixes down to the 10-meter surface level.
Okay, so it does translate down.
It does.
Yeah.
In fact, the National Weather Service's own worn-on forecast system uses 80-meter winds as a proxy for ground-level gusts. So while it is an imperfect proxy, it is highly credible based on real-world physics.
Okay, I'll buy that. So they run these 97 digitally perfect storms, which are built from the exact ingredients of days that produced actual property damage. And here's the jaw dropper of the whole paper, right? Only 35% of these simulated downbursts actually produced what the National Weather Service officially defines as severe winds.
Yeah, that statistic is staggering. And for context, the official severe threshold in the U.S. is 25.7 meters per second, which translates to roughly 58 miles per hour.
Wait, hold on. If only 35% hit that mark, that means 65% of the time, an environment that caused a real-world damage report couldn't even spin up a mathematically severe wind gust in a state-of-the-art supercomputer.
That's right.
So most of these storms doing the actual damage aren't technically severe.
It honestly forces a complete paradigm shift in how we think about summer weather. It suggests that the vast majority of wind damage reports we see from pole storms are actually coming from sub-severe winds.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. But we'll get to that in a moment, because the study also looked at that remaining 35%. You know, when a storm does manage to produce a true 58-mile-per-hour gust, the research reveals just how vanishingly rare it is to actually experience it in time and space.
Finding the needle in the haystack. So let's talk about the lifespan of these things. If a severe wind gust happens, like, how long does it last?
It is incredibly brief. The study found that winds over 58 miles per hour lasted an average of just 5.2 minutes.
5 minutes. That's nothing.
Right. And the peak intensity usually hits about 1,000 seconds, so a little over 15 minutes after the initial downburst reaches the ground. It is a violent, ephemeral burst, and then it's just gone.
Wow. And the physical footprint is microscopic, too. The simulated severe winds covered 10 square kilometers or less in almost all of the computer runs. Out of 97 total simulations, only 8 produced severe winds covering an area larger than 10 square kilometers.
And to visualize 10 square kilometers, I mean, imagine a patch of land about 2 miles by 2 miles.
That's really small.
Yeah. In the grand scheme of a county, let alone a whole state, it is basically a pinpoint on a map.
And to prove just how hard it is to measure this pinpoint, the researcher ran an experiment called a simulated network. They basically took digital weather station grids and dropped them randomly over the modeled wind fields to see if a station would actually catch the severe wind.
Yeah, they ran this test 100 times for different station layouts. And when they simulated a standard professional mezzanette, remember that's the one with station space 30 kilometers apart, the network had a measly 0.7% chance of observing the severe gust.
Less than a 1% chance. That is unbelievable. They even simulated a highly dense, specialized research grid called the MIST network, which has stations spaced just 2 kilometers apart.
Right. Super dense.
Yeah. Even with a weather station every 1.2 miles, the network only had a 43% chance of catching the peak wind. You still miss it more often than you catch it.
Which brings us to a really interesting mathematical concept the author adapted called the Nyquist frequency. It actually originates in signal processing.
Okay, break that down for us.
Essentially, to guarantee that you fully measure a signal, your sampling rate has to be twice as fine as the signal itself.
Oh, right. It's like digital audio or filming a helicopter blade. If your camera's frame rate isn't significantly faster than the spinning blade, the blade looks like it's standing perfectly still. or even spinning backward.
That's a beautiful analogy, exactly. Your camera has to be faster than the action. So in this case, your physical weather stations need to be packed tighter than the storm itself.
Which they aren't.
No, not at all. When you apply the Nyquist frequency to physical space on a map, to guarantee a standard 30-kilometer network catches a severe gust, the wind swath needs to cover what they call a minimum required area, or MRA, of nearly 4,500 square kilometers.
Okay, let's process that. A standard network needs the storm to be 4,500 square kilometers big to guarantee we see it. But the actual storms are less than 10 square kilometers big.
Yeah, the math doesn't work out.
It's like trying to catch a single firefly in a massive football stadium, but your fishing net has holes the size of a minivan.
It's a fundamental mismatch of scale. Mm-hmm. And it explains entirely why forecasters are basically flying blind with pulse thunderstorms. We are relying on an observation grid that is mathematically incapable of seeing the event it's supposed to warn us about.
Which naturally leads to my absolute favorite part of this entire paper, sort of the big aha moment. If these 58 mile per hour severe winds are incredibly rare, tiny, and brief, what on earth is causing all the widespread tree and power line damage in these storms? Because, you know, trees are absolutely falling down and crushing roofs.
The primary culprit is what meteorologists call subsevere winds. We're talking about wind speeds between 20 and 24 meters per second.
Which is roughly 45 to 53 miles per hour, right?
Exactly.
And the study found these subsevere winds occurred in 80% of the simulations. And unlike the severe winds that vanished in 5 minutes, these subsevere winds lasted an average of 25 minutes, and they covered vastly larger areas of land.
And this is where meteorological definitions collide head-on with engineering and biology. Forestry and wind engineering studies the paper site's work by Gardner, Shellhaus, and DuPont. They show that canopy-level tree damage actually begins between 10 and 20 meters per second.
Which blows my mind. The National Weather Service requires a 58-mile-per-hour wind to call a storm severe, but biological studies show that trees start snapping at 45 miles per hour or even lower.
Right. They can't always withstand that.
So we're using broken trees as proof of a 58-mile-per-hour wind, but the trees are actually tapping out way before that.
It really exposes a flaw in how we log weather data, honestly. National Weather Service Directive 10.5.11 specifically allows forecasters to use reliable reports of tree damage as verification that a 50-knot or 58-mile-per-hour gust occurred.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This study powerfully suggests that practice is scientifically broken. A broken branch or even a downed tree does not guarantee a severe wind occurred.
Because nature doesn't read the National Weather Service rulebook. I mean, think about a massive oak tree in mid-July. It's covered in heavy, wet leaves acting like a sail.
Oh, definitely.
The soil around the roots is completely saturated by a sudden downpour, turning the dirt to mud. A sustained 45-mile-per-hour wind pushing on that heavy tree in wet soil is going to topple it. The tree doesn't care if the Weather Service issued a severe warning or not.
You're exactly right. And this creates a massive, almost impossible problem for forecasters when it comes to public safety.
Mm.
Consider a standard NWS severe thunderstorm warning polygon.
Yeah.
You know, the box drawn on the radar map.
The one we see on TV.
Exactly. An average warning polygon covers about 8,802 square kilometers.
But the actual swath of severe wind only covers 10 square kilometers.
Right. So if a forecaster issues a warning, 99.4% of the warned area is technically experiencing a false alarm. People get the screaming alert on their phone, they look outside, maybe it rains a bit, but the trees aren't blowing sideways.
And the next time their phone goes off, they ignore it. It just creates major warning fatigue. But on the flip side, if the forecaster doesn't warn, and a 45-mile-per-hour subsevere gust knocks a tree onto a car or a house, the public immediately demands to know why they weren't warned.
It is a totally no-win situation.
Yeah.
And it's built on the fact that our definition of severe weather is rigid. But the vulnerability of our infrastructure and our urban forests is highly variable.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. If subsevere winds cover more area, last longer, and cause the bulk of the actual societal impacts in these summer storms, our entire warning strategy for pole storms might need to evolve. We might need flexible warning criteria based on, like, the local environment, the current soil moisture, and the type of native vegetation.
Okay, let's take a step back and just sort of summarize what we've unpacked today, because
yeah.
This really changes how I'll look at the sky this summer. Wet downbursts from weakly forced summer thunderstorms are incredibly localized, violently short-lived events driven by evaporative cooling and precipitation drag, pulling cold air to the ground.
Perfectly summarized, yeah.
And our current radar networks often shoot right over them, and our surface weather stations are spaced way too far apart to catch them, leaving a massive blind spot.
And when researchers put these environments into high-resolution supercomputer simulations, they find that the real danger to our neighborhoods isn't necessarily the rare 60-mile-per-hour severe gust.
Right.
It is the incredibly common 45-mile-per-hour subsevere gust that lasts longer, covers more ground, and is perfectly capable of bringing down the urban canopy.
Now, we always have to remember that these are idealized models. Mm. They assume flat terrain, they use simulated thermodynamic environments, and they use 50-meter winds as a proxy for surface gusts. But even with those scientific limitations, this study opens a massive window into a previously invisible weather threat. It completely explains why your street got hammered while the next block over was perfectly fine.
It absolutely challenges the foundations of how we verify storms and how we warn the public. It tells us that what we observe in the record books is heavily filtered by how we observe it.
So next time a sudden summer storm rolls through and brings down a massive branch in your yard, consider this. Maybe the weather wasn't technically severe by the strict definition of the meteorological record books. But what if our very definition of severe weather has been biased all along by the limits of our instruments, rather than the reality of the world we actually live in?